to a local granite hewn officer. Do they mine all British policemen from the same quarry? Whose doubtful expression is, I have to hope, habitual, rather than specific to this case. By this case, I mean Caro's poisoning of me. Nobody is talking to me about Caro's murder of Severine, which I don't understand and can never quite seem to get a straight answer on. Mordan and his British colleague come to talk with me. They go away, they come again. Or perhaps it is me that leaves and returns. Lara comes too, bringing magazines I can't read because the words crawl around the page. But she also brings chocolate and grapes and flowers, and herself. I hear the full story of my rescue. She paints a picture that has Mordan glittering in the forefront, and I can't help thinking that my near death is almost entirely responsible for the resurrection of their romance. Honestly, she says, in a half-awed tone, he was brilliant. I was totally beside myself, but he knew exactly what to do. Really, you should have been there. Well, I say drolly, I was, actually. Her face sobers instantly. God, I know, I know. You know what I meant. I'm sorry. I reach for her hand remorsefully, and we share a smile that's a little wobbly on her side. And then? Mordan? She blushes. Well, once we knew you were out of immediate danger, he took me home. It must have been about 6 in the morning. He grabbed croissants from that bakery on the corner by my flat. You know the one? It opens really early. Anyway, we had croissants, and then he tucked me up in bed, and he was going to leave. But I didn't want to be alone, so he stayed, and he didn't try anything. He was just totally taking care of me, and well, it's gone from there, really. The giddiness in her eyes and her voice again, it creates a glow that lights up her very skin. He's going to apply for a post with this international liaison department that's based in London. It's kind of like Interpol, I think. It's a move he was thinking about anyway, but there's an opening coming up. Anyway, she says, with a meaningful look, what about you and Tom? I find I'm blushing too. Tom is here somewhere. He has just nipped out to get coffee for Lara. Tom is here. Tom is almost always here, to the point where yesterday I asked him if he still had a job. He gently pointed out it was Sunday, but that makes today Monday. It does, doesn't it? Yes, it does. And he's still here, holding my hand, dropping kisses on my unwashed hair. Yet we've never talked about what that means. I'm saved from having to answer Lara's question by the return of the man himself, armed with 3 coffees, though we all know I will fall asleep before I can drink mine. Finally, Mordan and the British policeman come to see me with serious expressions that, head injury notwithstanding, I can interpret without them even having to open their mouths. You're not charging her, I say flatly, though they've yet to take a seat. I'm sitting up in bed in my private room. Thank God I didn't scrimp on health cover when I set up my own company. Tom, who was idly flicking through the sports section of a newspaper on a chair beside me, rises to meet Mordan, with what I can only describe as a man-hug. I keep meaning to ask about that, but I haven't. Another thing that has slipped through a crack. Well, says PC Stone, whose name isn't Stone, and who isn't a PC either. He's probably a DI or something, but neither of those details will stick for me. No, we're not. He spreads his hands wide, but the gesture is blunt and choppy. It lacks Mordan's elegant sweep. Then he hitches his trouser legs to settle in a chair and leans forward, elbows on knees, his broad, thick head, topped with short, gingerous bristles, jutting forward like a bull preparing to charge. It would take more than a sea of white tiles to put a dent into that skull. Mordan remains standing, seemingly just to emphasize the differences between the two, the stocky Brit and the beanpole Frenchman, one direct and no-nonsense, the other deviously charming. It's actually a pretty effective mix. The thing is, it's just a he said, she said. Surely a she said, she said. But he's still talking. I must concentrate or I will lose track. There's no evidence she was even at your flat. No fingerprints on the wine bottle.
Not even Kate's?
Asks Tom meaningfully.
Not even Kate's, which, yes, is strange, but it doesn't prove a case against Miss Orridge. The date Kate's phone was updated with the dealer's number matches the date of her party, but that hardly proves anything.
He scratches at his stubble, his frustrated dissatisfaction clear.
You're not charging her, I repeat.
Mordan, silent up till now, steps forward, his expression earnest.
What can we do? There's no evidence.
There isn't any evidence on Severine's murder, but you still seemed to be trying hard to pin it on me, I say tartly.
Mordan blows out a breath.
I'm afraid you are behind the times. The case has been closed.
I stare at him. You've arrested Caro. I wait for a wave of relief, but it doesn't come. He shakes his head.
No, there is not enough evidence on that also. But the investigation has been closed. It is politically unpopular, shall we say. But that is how it is.
Closed? Over? Over. No more threat of arrest. But Lara's words come back to me. It's never really over. Even if they consign it to the cold case pile, it could still come alive again. Can it be truly over without a conviction? I find myself looking for Severine again, before I remember that she isn't here anymore.
Mordan nods grimly.
Closed.
I can see it irks him.
I know who was responsible, but there is nothing I can do. Without evidence.
Evidence. He says it heavily, emphatically, in his French accent, whilst holding my gaze. Evidence. It feels like he is challenging me.
I know who was responsible too, and it wasn't me. Ah, but you misunderstand me, he says, shaking his head. I have never thought it was you.
I stare at him.
Well, not for a long time, at least,
he amends, and I find a bark of laughter escaping me. He grins back at me, sly humor in those clever eyes.
Really? Why not?
Asks Tom, with what sounds like academic interest.
Because she drove, of course, he says to Tom, as if it was self-evident. All the way back.
Tom and I exchange glances. Not comprehending. But no one else was insured, I say blankly.
Exactement. You wouldn't bend the rules, not even for that. I could not make it fit. I could not believe you killed her on purpose. And if you had killed her, by accident, you would have called les gendarmes, the police, the ambulance. It is not in your nature to deceive. Et voilà.
It could not be you. Tom and I share another glance, slightly dazed. Even PC Stone seems a little taken aback by this remarkably unscientific explanation.
I suppose instinct is part of your job, says Tom after a moment.
It sounds like he is trying not to look a gift horse in the mouth.
True, admits PC Stone, though he too still seems thrown. It is very much in Caro's nature to deceive, Tom presses.
Caro. So this is how it will be. Caro will get what she wants. Perhaps not immediately, but she plays a long game. Sooner or later, Alina will be swept aside in some as yet unknown way. And then Caro will have Seb, partnership at Hafton Wild, and a field clear of rivals. I can just imagine her now. Whispering to Seb about how poor, deranged Kate tried to kill herself and blame it on her. And not just whispering to Seb, come to think of it. So desperately sad about Kate. She obviously had some kind of breakdown. She overdosed and blamed it on me. Can you imagine? I mean, the police even investigated her claim. But of course there was no truth to it, so they had to drop it. Poor girl. In that moment, my stomach drops.
as I realize my business is over. There is no return from this. It doesn't matter that the police are dropping the Severine case. Carol will never cease in her rumor-mongering. I look at Tom, and by the bleakness in his expression, I can see he's drawn the same conclusion.
Mordan nods heavily.
We found cocaine in the auto, Sir Jacques. Down in the seams, of the driver's seat. I think she was in love with Seb. I think she has always been in love with him. I think she was delighted when Kate and Seb had a fight. She thought it was her turn, n'est-ce pas?
Ordinarily a man of gestures, he is unusually still, allowing his words the space to have maximum impact.
It must have enraged her beyond reason to find him taking up with Severine. I expect it was just chance, that she happened to be in the jag as Severine came by en route to her house. And in her fury, Carol lost control.
I stare at Mordan, even as I see it unfold. Severine with her hand to her bloody temple, caught in the headlights of the approaching, accelerating jag.
But she would have immediately realized that she couldn't allow the police to be called, with the drugs in her system. Even if she wasn't charged for murder, it would be the end of her legal career. Other than Seb, that has always been the most important thing in her life.
I continue to stare at him, slightly disturbed by his ability to casually condense a whole person to two main ambitions. But he's right. Partnership at Hafton Wild and Seb are at the root of everything.
So, she disposed of the body.
By herself? Asks Tom softly.
Mordan knows what he is asking.
I don't know for sure, he says, equally softly. But I would think she must have had help.
Tom nods, looking at the floor. Mordan's gaze rests on him for a moment, and then he continues.
The car has damage to the undercarriage, but it is impossible to tell how long that has been there. And we can't prove Miss Orridge was in the car, even with the cocaine. We can't even prove Severine died as a result of a eat-and-run.
He spreads his hands, his mouth twisted in regret.
We are too late to prove anything.
But she went to the train station to mislead everyone. That's why she was late when I wanted to leave. All the while I was driving back, desperately unhappy behind the wheel of my little car, Carol was settled in the back, fresh from covering up a murder. How is it possible I couldn't tell? Like I told you, with her hair up in a turban, like Severine wore it, it's quite hard to tell she's blonde. I see Carol again with the red trilby, superimposed on Severine's image. Can't your bone measurement thingy prove it was her?
Mordan is already nodding. Oui, I have thought that for a while. A very smart thing to do, in fact. But again, no hard evidence. We can prove it could have been her at the depot, but we can't prove it definitely was her. There is no stomach for a high-profile loss on this. Perhaps, if it was less political...
At last, PC Stone speaks up.
I couldn't agree with you more about the character of Miss Horridge, he says heavily.
His hand is working his red-tinged stubble again. He is the sort of man who must have to shave twice a day if he has an evening out planned.
Given we can't get her on the French murder, we were really hoping to nail her on attempted murder of you. Is there really nothing else you can tell us? Nobody who might have seen her, heard you talking. We've asked all your neighbours, but nothing.
You spoke to Ben, from across the hall?
Ken, says Mordan. Ken Moorland.
There's no judgment in his tone, but I feel it all the same. My memory, or lack of it, is the elephant in the room. Though aren't elephants supposed to never forget? I never really did catch his name, I mutter mutinously. PC Stone clears his throat.
Yeah, well, anyway, we spoke to him. He said you appeared to be alone when he delivered the flowers, and then he went out for a bit. He got back as the ambulance was just leaving.
Flowers. I look at Tom and almost wail. But your flowers will be dead.
He smiles. No matter, I can buy you more, and with more romantic cards if you like.
But still, this mention of flowers is tugging at something, a tendril of a thought that curls up from a crack. The flowers, the card, all my secrets in one dark pocket, my clothes! I exclaim suddenly.
Dr. Page won't let you up yet, says Tom, warningly.
No! I mean the clothes I was wearing. Where are they?
They're in evidence, says PC Stone.
There was something in my pocket.
Mordan speaks up.
Perhaps you are a little tired. We should come back later, no?
No, no, this is actually relevant, I say testily. There were two things in my pocket. The card from the flowers and a dictaphone. I don't know if it will have picked up much, but maybe.
Once again I feel my hand slipping quietly into my pocket and slipping back out again just as quietly. Suddenly Mordan and PC Stone look a lot more interested.
A dictaphone? You're sure? Says PC Stone.
I nod.
But there's nothing in evidence, he objects.
A dictaphone, did you say? Looks a bit like a mini cassette player, yes? Oh, that's in your top drawer, says a breezy voice from across the room.
It's the nurse. I didn't notice her coming in to check on the bathroom supplies.
It looks a bit bashed up, I'm afraid.
I turn toward the drawers, but Mordan is faster, pulling a glove out of his pocket. He rummages in the drawer and comes out with the little black device in his gloved hand, turning it over carefully. One corner looks crushed, and a crack runs across the face of it. Both the dictaphone and I bear the marks of the crash to the tiles.
I'm working, mostly. Is it?
It was in my pocket, I say, horribly anxious. I don't know how much that will have muffled the sound, and it's pretty old anyway. It's not even digital.
Tom takes my hand, and I realize I'm babbling, so I trail off. Mordan is carefully rewinding the tape, which makes a whining sound I don't remember, and stutters and grates from time to time, causing me to hold my breath each time until it recovers. And then it stops abruptly. Mordan's eyes catch mine and hold for a beat. Then he presses play.
I'm talking, but my mouth isn't moving. Arrange to meet candidate in advance of the... Stockley's recruitment drive becoming common knowledge. Have Julie arrange on Monday.
I shake my head at Mordan, still linked to his eyes, and talk over myself.
No, this isn't it.
But the tape abruptly switches scene. Indistinct, muffled sounds can be heard. And then indistinct voices. There's almost certainly a woman, probably two. It certainly sounds like a not-quite-heard conversation. Mordan raises his eyebrow, and I nod back imperceptibly. Then he looks for a volume knob. It's already at maximum.
I can't, I start, but Mordan holds up a hand to silence me.
So we listen, the four of us, to a conversation played out too far beyond the veil of time and technology to be audible. Tantalizing words slip out. I hear Darren Lucas, I hear accusations, I hear flowers. But I have the benefit of having been at the first screening. Tom looks utterly in the dark. But still, even with my advantage, it's plain to me the tape is not clear enough. It was all for nothing. We sit, as the gently rotating tape spools out into our silence, and I consider my future. I can't pick up and start again. The rumors will never die. What on earth will I do? The words mostly peter out after a while, dwindling to short snatches interspersed with indistinct movements. It's oddly soporific. But then the recording ends with an overloud scrunch, as if something bashed the microphone. I remember that crunch distinctly, the sea of white tiles rising up to meet me. Mordan presses stop,
with a theatrical click. It's useless. Even to me, I sound hollow.
Not at all, says Mordan, seeming oddly pleased. I suddenly realize even PC Stone is almost smiling.
We hear two people, two women, speaking. If we can hear this much, the technicians will be able to do a great deal with this, we?
PC Stone nods in agreement. Then Mordan turns back to me.
Bravo, madame.
Madame. It gives me a jolt. I am madame now, whereas Severine will always be the mademoiselle next door. It takes the edge off the swelling hope that perhaps all is not lost after all.
Though I have to say, interjects the British policeman, somewhat reluctantly, his face returning to its usual granite. It's not strictly legal to record a conversation without permission.
It was an accident, offers Tom, deadpan. She often has the dictaphone in her pocket, and it's quite easy to knock it on. I nod furiously, despite the fact that I only use the dictaphone perhaps once or twice a month.
Is that so? Says PC Stone dryly. He looks at Mordan.
An accident, says Mordan, his eyes gleaming. He spreads his hands wide. A happy accident. These things happen, we?
I suppose they do, says his colleague reluctantly, though I can see a corner of his mouth twitching as he climbs to his feet. Right, we'd better get that to the technicians. No promises, but I'm hopeful. If we can just at least prove she was there.
Tom and I watch them depart, looking even more like a comedy duo now that there is a lightness to their mood.
It won't work, you know, says Tom gently.
I turn to him with eyebrows raised. The bleakness hasn't left his eyes. I don't want you to get your hopes up. They might arrest her, but they won't nail her for it.
Why do you say that?
He sighs.
Because she's Caro. She'll get the best legal representation money can buy. Her dad will make sure of that.
You'd need physical evidence and a sworn confession to convict her. Nothing less will do. And they don't have the first, and I'm pretty sure, even after the police do their technical wizardry, that tape won't amount to a sworn confession. I could be wrong, but... I stare at him while I think it through. Did she actually confess? It's hard to pick through my fragmented memory.
Enough to fell an elephant.
So she did confess, but will the tape have caught it? Where was she standing when she said that? Where was I? I don't remember. It slipped through a crack.
So that's it? You think she gets away with it?
He nods unhappily. I try to fit the pieces together myself, to come up with a different answer. But I can't. The injustice hollows me out. I ought to want to rail at something, or someone, but who, or what?
So she gets away with it, and I get left with nothing. I say dully at last.
Well, he says, taking my hand and staring at it intently. Not exactly nothing, I hope. He looks up, and the intensity in his gaze steals my breath. It tore me in pieces to see you in here. I can't imagine what the hell I've been playing at, waiting on the sidelines all these years. I don't intend to wait a single second more. I stare at him. Tom. My Tom. The Tom I should have always known he was.
All these years?
All these years. There's a hint of a smile at the corners of his mouth.
But you've slept with Lara.
I don't know why I'm throwing up obstacles given that I adore this man. He rolls his eyes. I was 21 and my cousin was sleeping with my dream girl. Sure, I was madly, unbelievably jealous, but that didn't make me a monk. And anyway, you've slept with my cousin many times. That'll be much harder to explain round the family table at Christmas.
We haven't even slept together yet, I muse thoughtfully.
He waggles his eyebrows suggestively. I'd love to remedy that immediately, but the nursing staff might not be so keen on the idea. But our first kiss held definite promise. He holds my gaze, and something moves between us, a current that thickens the air into something solid enough to lean into. So, he whispers, in a low murmur that takes me right back to that dark, delicious corridor. Are you in? I'm in, I whisper. And then he's kissing me. And I find I am feeling very much better indeed. Chapter 21. Time passes. I can't keep it, or save it, or mark it. The ribbon slips through my fingers regardless. And time shows that Tom is right, of course. The dictaphone tape is cleaned up, but not all of it is audible. Crucially, not the part where Carol confessed to dumping roofies in my wine, if that confession truly happened at all, though it remains fixed in my memory. Despite the lack of confession, the police question Carol, and they even find her drug dealer, the unexpected casualty in all of this, as his is the only actual arrest. They leave no stone unturned. It is my repeated and most fervent wish that this investigation has completely annihilated any chances of Carol making partner this time round. Surely, even more than the Severine investigation, it must be diverting her attention from that process. But, in the face of the finest legal representation money can buy, Tom was right on that too. The decision is made not to prosecute. By that point I am back at work, hollow-cheeked but clear-eyed, with most of my cracks papered over. Paul did an admirable job of holding the Channing Associates fort in my absence by the remarkably sensible solution of promoting Julie to work alongside him and hiring a temporary secretary. Julie, it turns out, loves the role, and I can't bring myself to demote her, so now I am up a headcount, with zero prospect of raising any new contracts, given the impending tidal wave of gossip that is no doubt beginning to circulate. We are diligently working out the contracts we do have, but every time I talk with Paul, I find myself imagining scales behind his eyes, weighing up the best time to jump. Still, I'm actually relieved to have Julie in place. The first few weeks back at work are incredibly exhausting, and I barely pull my weight. Neither of them quite understand what happened, though I suspect Tom may have told Paul more than I realize. Anyway, in communications to clients, Paul wisely blamed my hospitalization on an accidental blow to the head, and left the rest well alone. The Haft and Weil contract hasn't been revoked, to my surprise. Paul picked it up in my absence, liaising with someone other than Caro, due to the need for her to focus on the partnership selection process. Official line only, I hope. I have made no move to regain control of it. Therefore, it's a complete surprise to find Gordon Farrow waiting by my office front door when I step outside one lunchtime to get a sandwich. I grind to a halt halfway down the steps. Hello, he says, diffidently, when I make no sound. I don't suppose you expected to see me? No, I reply warily. I didn't. Can I buy you a coffee? It's very much a question. He shows no expectation of a positive response. Perhaps that's why I nod. There's a cafe this way where we can get a sandwich too if you haven't eaten. I glance at him as we walk along. He looks like he always does. A nondescript man in all respects. He must be appraising me too, as he says. I'm glad to see you looking so well. How do you feel? Tired, I say, yawning messily on cue. Head injuries can do that, apparently. We find a table in the cafe and settle down, each of us hiding behind the menu. It's not the same cafe as the one where Lara and I experienced the bird incident, but I still find myself glancing at the window, and almost exclaim aloud when I see Severine sauntering by in her black shift dress. She turns her head and eyes me coolly, then continues down the pavement outside, away from the cafe. What does it mean, that she is back? Is she staying? Or is this her version of goodbye?
I'm so pleased you agreed to meet with me, Gordon says abruptly, putting down the menu.
I drag my attention back to him, resisting the urge to crane my neck to see if she has really gone.
I wasn't sure you would. I should have known you wouldn't blame me for any difficulties between you and Caro.
Difficulties? I put down my own menu.
Difficulties, Gordon. Is that the right word? She tried to kill me. She put so much Rohypnol in my drink that she damn near succeeded, so forgive me if I find the word difficulties a little too weak.
There is no evidence of that. He tries to hold my gaze, but even his legendary steel is wavering.
So I'm told, doesn't mean it didn't happen. If you'd heard the tape...
I heard it. He looks away.
Who?
I start, but the waitress comes to take our order. She is a plump brunette, continually smiling, even as she speaks. I can't imagine why she's quite this happy at work. It's jarring. When she leaves, I find Gordon appraising me again.
You're angry with me, he says mildly.
Yes.
Because I stand by her. She's my daughter. Failing evidence to the contrary, I have to believe her.
He explains this like it's an intellectual discussion on the finer points of a legal draft.
Do you have to?
I consider that. Perhaps. I don't know.
What would you do if there was evidence, but she claimed it was all fabricated?
He shrugs, with a slight smile I don't entirely understand.
Anyway, that's not why I'm angry with you.
His control is superb.
Why then?
Because I do blame you, for her behavior, you and your wife. You are partly responsible. How did she come to believe this kind of behavior is allowed? Where were the boundaries when she was growing up? You got divorced, and then you felt guilty and you let her get away with murder, and then, well, then getting away with murder wasn't a metaphor anymore.
I stop and pick up my water glass, feeling oddly shaky after my savage words. I had no idea that was going to come out of my mouth. Is that how I really feel about it? Do I really blame him? He looks at me sadly, saying nothing until the silence stretches out. I find myself holding my breath for a response. I shouldn't care at all what Gordon thinks of me, but it's clear I do. Finally, he sighs.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with your position, but I do fully respect your right to say it. In truth, there is very little you could say to make me feel any more wretched than I already do.
In that moment I can see through to the anguish in his eyes.
Well, I say, after a moment, I'm sure it's not as simple as all that.
He inclines his head, acknowledging my softening. The waitress has returned with our drinks, her smile in no way dimmed. Surely her cheeks must hurt.
There is one thing I wanted to tell you, before it becomes common knowledge, Gordon says, as he stirs milk into his coffee.
Yes?
Caro has been suspended from Hafton Wild.
My eyes fly to his face. He smiles a little ruefully at my shock.
Why?
I ask warily, when he doesn't add anything further. He sips his coffee.
As I already mentioned, the police played me the tape. A French detective it was. Very bright chap, I thought.
I mentally cheer Mordan as he shrugs.
Our firm can't afford to ignore allegations of impropriety around the partnership process. I would have done the same with any employee, and Caro cannot be treated any differently.
You took it to the operating committee?
I must be round-eyed in shock.
Yes, I was duty-bound to.
This is arguably true, but still, his own daughter. I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that he reported allegations against his own daughter to the operating committee of the firm. The integrity of that action is staggering.
Therefore, we have been further investigating Darren Lucas's case, and he has been entirely exonerated.
And Caro?
The evidence seems to be stacking up against her. She's suspended, pending the final results of the investigation. He pauses, then says delicately, "She claims the evidence is fabricated. So I suppose I will find out the answer to your question in time." I can't help it. I start to laugh. After a beat, he joins in with a half-hearted chuckle or two. "So my most fervent wish is to be granted. Carol will not now be a partner at Hafton Weil, or any other legal firm for that matter. I can't imagine how she will reconcile herself to that. For the first time in her life, there is a boundary she cannot bend or cross. And then it also occurs to me that a disgraced, struck-off lawyer is much less likely to be believed when attempting to spread scurrilous rumours. I try to imagine Carol in disgrace, stripped of her stellar career, robbed of her brittle artifice, and disturbingly find myself imagining a defenceless baby bird."
"It's not actually in the least bit funny," Gordon says sadly, when the black humour has subsided.
"Yes," I say soberly, both Severine and the baby bird image still stuck in my mind.
"I know."
We are lying, Tom and I, propped on our sides in the darkness of Tom's bedroom. He has blackout blinds, a concept he liked in Boston and brought back to London, and the darkness is a complete absence of light. It's a comfort to me now. I think of it like a physical place, a retreat we like to run to where we are safely cocooned and can just be. Tom's hand is idly running up and down the length of my arm, from shoulder to elbow. The promise that always lurked in his hugs is borne out in the bedroom. He touches with just the right amount of pressure, firm and deliberate, but never too much. He makes me giddy, and he makes me safe. I know I have to tell him. I can't think of a way to do it except to just do it.
"I see, Severine," I blurt out.
Tom's hand halts, a short hitch, then continues on its route at a slower pace. "I mean, obviously I don't really see her. This isn't the sixth sense. But I see her. Ever since you told me they found her in the well, it used to be her bones sometimes, her skull. But now it's mostly her. She went away for a bit after I hit my head. But she's back again."
Tom doesn't say anything.
Do you think I'm crazy?"
"Kind of," he says,
but I can hear the smile in his voice. "I take it you don't see Theo then?"
"No."
He's quiet for a moment, his hand arrested in its trail. My skin misses it. The bones within miss it.
"It's more like, sometimes I see his absence. Once I notice it, it's hard to get past it. A space where he should be."
I can hear rather than see a wry smile on his face.
"Maybe I don't have your imagination to fill the gap."
I think about that as we lie there, the darkness folding around us, holding us safe. Am I filling the gap? Though Severine was never a part of my world, or my friendships. It doesn't seem to quite fit, as an explanation. But perhaps there's something to it.
"Does she talk?" asks Tom suddenly.
"No."
Except perhaps for one vital occasion.
Silently, enigmatic.
He laughs softly. "I imagine she would have liked that description. Sounds like you've recreated her perfectly."
His hand takes up its trail again.
"It's strange, though. I mean, it's not like you two were friends or anything."
"Hardly.
So it's strange your mind should fix on her, of all people."
"I'm sure a shrink would have a field day with it all." I say it with a small laugh, but I'm really waiting for his response. This, after all, is the crux of this conversation. He hesitates, unusually awkward for Tom, feeling his way.
"Do you want to speak to someone about it?"
I hadn't imagined that question. I consider it. "Not really. It's not normal, exactly. but it's not a problem either. I've become accustomed to it. I've become accustomed to her, I should say. I like to think she has become accustomed to me also.
Tom falls silent, thinking. The trail is moving up and down along my hip now, from just under my breast, sweeping over the swell of my hip bone, and along the line of my thigh.
Then I don't see a problem. I smile to myself. Bless him for his pragmatism.
Is she here now?
No, I say, though in truth it's too dark to tell.
Good.
He starts to follow his trailing hand with his lips.
I'd rather not have an audience.
And so the lovely ribbon of time keeps slipping through my fingers. We see Lara and Alan. We see Seb and Alina. As a group, we don't talk of the week in France. And we don't talk of Caro. For a while, it's an awkward subject we're all avoiding, a stain across our memories that we slide our eyes away from. We were all guilty of suspecting one another. We are all tarred. But life moves on, and in time we have so much else to talk about. And after all, no one sees Caro. I see Severine, but I know I'm the only one. From time to time, I notice that Tom doesn't see Theo. Tom and I talk about France. We talk about Severine. We both dread the day someone across the channel takes it in their mind to trawl through cold cases and decides to reopen this one. I know there will never be enough evidence to convict Caro, so all that can happen is months of distress and no satisfactory outcome. Not that this current outcome is satisfactory, though it is an outcome. Ultimately, Darren Lucas went to the police, and Carol was prosecuted for fraud, though her sentence was suspended. It's hardly a murder conviction, or even an attempted murder conviction, but she can never practice law again. She can never be a partner at her father's firm, and Seb has cut her off completely. A messy, oblique sort of justice, if it's justice at all, though I think for her it's somehow fitting. I don't know what she is doing now, or where she is doing it. I don't think of the baby bird. And then, one day I do see Caro, in an airport lounge. I'm hunched over my phone in an armchair, trying to connect to the airport Wi-Fi, and she sits next to me. "Hello, Kate," she says. My head lifts, and there she is. Caro. I'm completely floored. Her name slips out before I can stop myself from saying anything at all. She's dressed in casual clothes, jeans and a blazer, typically stylish. She looks older, of course, and just as thin. Her hair is a brighter color than I remember. "I'm sure you don't want to talk to me," she begins, high color is climbing her cheeks. "I don't. Leave. I just..." But I've grabbed my bag, and I'm out of the armchair before the rest of her sentence can reach me. I cannot allow myself to expend one iota more of mental energy on Caro. I don't even tell Tom I saw her. I refuse to waste the seconds it would take. I never see Caro again. Severine, though, I do see. If I'd ever entertained the notion that once the case was solved she would depart, turn and walk happily. Not happily exactly, not Severine, but at least not reluctantly, into a bright light, perhaps, or evaporate slowly like an early morning mist that fades with the rising of the sun. Well, if I'd ever expected that, it's not to be. Severine still hovers. Perhaps, one might say, not as much as before. It's instructive to note what piques her interest. On the whole, family life seems to bore her. She was nowhere to be seen for the birth of our children. She's much more likely to make an appearance in my workplace, or any kind of event I'm dreading. The parents' socials at the twin school, for example. Tom reckons it's a reaction to stress, to which I reply with a certain vehemence that the twins' birth was about as stressful as anything I can imagine, and where the hell was she then? He just shakes his head, amused, and says, "Not that sort of stress." Tom is often amused now. Gently, and also to the point of genuine laughter. We both laugh more. I can't remember a point in my life up until now when I have laughed this often. It's the twins, especially at the age they are now. They are literal, no room for greys. They don't understand irony or cynicism. They strip that away from us, and instead extract an exaggerated politeness and a readiness to laugh. They make us into the people we want them to see. They make us kinder, more tired certainly, but kinder. Channing Associates makes me tired too. We are seven now, with larger offices, and champagne glasses hidden in the back of one cupboard, in case we have new contracts to toast. Paul is smugly satisfied that he stayed, but no less bipolar. Gordon Farrow has become the firm's informal mentor, and I meet him at least monthly for lunch or dinner, and often more. We don't talk of Caro. Sometimes I wonder if he is a father figure to me now, in which case, am I a daughter figure? Though I should know by now not to assume symmetry in relationships. And so, the lovely ribbon of time keeps slipping through my fingers, and through it all, a walnut-brown girl with impossibly slender limbs saunters by, her dark, unreflective eyes taking everything in, but revealing nothing. I never do see her smile. Acknowledgements. So, here's the thing. It turns out writing acknowledgements is hugely stressful and difficult. You're trying to be grateful, sincere, funny, and all-encompassing within 2 pages or less, which is no mean feat. Consequently, I've decided to set the bar a little lower and just tick the sincerity box. And if at the end of this you think I've missed anyone, please accept my very sincere apologies. Firstly, I'm enormously indebted to my absolutely wonderful agent, Marcy Posner, who has provided unending encouragement, cajolement, and invaluable editorial advice ever since we met. It has been, and continues to be, a pleasure working with you. Marcy, please accept an entire universe of thanks. To Kerry Donovan and all of the team at Berkeley, enormous thanks for getting behind The French Girl. As a debut author, I have only just begun to understand the hard work and dedication that is required to get a book on the shelves. I'm hugely appreciative and rather awestruck to have all that talent and commitment focused on my novel. Thanks all. To my family, Matt and our gorgeous boys, Cameron and Zachary, and my wider family, Elliot's and Davison's all, and to all my lovely friends, I know you are my biggest fans. Thank you so much for being so endlessly supportive. Of course, you also make it kind of hard to write, because there's always something else that's fun going on with you all, but I won't hold it against you. To all who have provided enlightenment and advice on the process of writing over the years, including the various presenters at the Writers' Workshop Festival of Writing, and the extremely helpful people at Cornerstone's Literary Consultancy, many thanks for helping me find my own voice. To the staff of any and every cafe that I have sat in to write, and particularly the staff of the Roehampton Club Cafe, which is my favorite place to write. Many thanks for keeping me fed and watered. And to Severine, thanks for showing up. I couldn't have written this without you. This is Catherine McEwan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The French Girl by Lexi Elliott. This program was directed by Arthur Morey, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Lexi Elliott. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.